the statement of gender, not the statement of generality of members. It's just talking about some of the angels being the messengers, not all of them. And then at the end of the verse says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ. And this means that it is not such that, like human beings, Allah is unaware of His messengers in their absence. On the contrary, He is always aware of their circumstances. إِنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ بَصِيرٌ. Verily, Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. So, He hears their words, and at the same time, He sees their deeds all the time.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Somehow, it could be inferred from this verse that whoever we choose, the one who is chosen by us, by the Almighty Allah, will be under control supervision, will be under full control. So verily, Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. So if we give responsibility and if we authorize someone to have a higher position, we will have definitely complete supervision on them. And not everyone is qualified to receive the messages of the Almighty Allah. Not everyone is qualified to be messenger of the Almighty Allah. And that's why the next verse starts saying, يَعْلَمُ مَا بَيْنَ أَيْدِيهِمْ وَمَا خَلْفَهُمْ. In this verse, which we will talk about inshallah in the next program, the Noble Quran is pointing to the responsibility of the messengers in conveying their prophecy from one side and the divine protections due to them on the other side. We will inshallah talk about that in the later program. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins.
The International Criminal Court has announced that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel since 1967. This decision will allow the ICC to investigate potential war crimes carried out by Israel for the first time. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On February 5th, 2021, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, headquartered in The Hague, published a ruling establishing its jurisdiction in Palestine. This jurisdictional ruling from the ICC's pretrial chamber 1 establishes that Palestine's West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, which Israel has been illegally occupying since 1967, are indeed in the scope of the ICC's territorial jurisdiction, and therefore it can proceed with investigating potential war crimes committed by Israel. In 2019, the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, had already established through a preliminary investigation that the situation in Palestine did indeed meet the Rome Statute's criteria for an investigation. However, before proceeding, she sought the court's opinion on whether the Palestinian territories fell under the ICC's jurisdiction. In 2012, Palestine achieved non-member observer state status at the United Nations and then acceded to the statute in 2015. The Rome Statute is the treaty that established the International Criminal Court in 1998. It was formed with the objective of holding individuals accountable for violating international law, specifically war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. 123 countries are state parties to the Rome Statute. However, Sudan, Russia, Israel, and the United States, despite signing the treaty, informed the UN Undersecretary General that they intended to no longer become a party to the treaty. Of course, the United States and Israel would have good reason to. If they ratified the treaty, most likely every single U.S. president and Israeli prime minister would be convicted of war crimes and genocide going back at least several decades, including a majority of their cabinets. The U.S. is currently being investigated by the ICC for war crimes in Afghanistan. And when Trump was in office, he actually put sanctions on the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, and Fakiso Mochochoku, the ICC's director of jurisdiction, in order to block them from carrying out their investigation or being able to travel to the United States. There are several reasons why the ICC, under Fatou Bensouda, has chosen to investigate Israel and potentially Hamas and the PA for war crimes. This includes predominantly Israel's invasion and brutal assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014. Codenamed Operation Protective Edge, this was by far one of the most horrific moments in Palestine's history under the Zionist occupation, which is really saying something. Israel, at the time, launched a ground invasion of Gaza in July of 2014. During this period, which lasted around 7 weeks until August 26th, a United Nations report said that the scale of devastation was unprecedented. Palestinians fired around 4,800 rockets and 1,750 mortars, killing 67 Israeli soldiers and 6 civilians. At the same time, Israel carried out 6,000 airstrikes, fired 14,500 tank shells and 45,000 artillery shells. The death toll among Palestinians reached 2,252. 65% of them were civilians. 25% of them were children. On top of that, 11,000 Palestinians were left wounded. This is horrific. According to the UN's estimates at the time, up to 1,000 children would be left permanently disabled as a result of the hostilities in 2014. The report also said that post-traumatic stress disorder and other stress-related symptoms have increased, and about 20% of the population in Gaza are estimated to be in need of long-term mental health assistance, among them at least 373,000 children. Israel targeted residential buildings on purpose, with the vast majority of victims dying either in or near their homes. This was clearly a strategy ordered at the highest levels of Israeli government. In total, the United Nations estimates that 178,000 homes were damaged or destroyed, and 100,000 Palestinians were left homeless. After this horrific war, Israel then barred construction materials from even entering Gaza so that to prevent Palestinians from rebuilding. To this day, Gaza is still under siege and looks like this. Israel also shelled several United Nations facilities, as it has done in other countries before, like Lebanon. In total, 118 UNRWA installations were damaged, including 83 schools and 10 health centers. Among other crimes envisioned in the scope of the ICC's investigation are the wave of killings and brutal injuries inflicted on Palestinians during the Right to Return marches from 2018 to 2019. During this time, the Israeli occupation forces inflicted immeasurable casualties on unarmed, innocent Palestinians who were protesting peacefully for the right to return to their land. Israeli forces deliberately targeted Palestinians in their lower limbs by shooting them in their knees. According to a report by the United Nations, in this period alone, 6,100 Palestinians were injured with live ammunition and another 3,000 by bullet fragmentation, rubber-coated metal bullets, or by hits from tear gas canisters. 122 people had to have their limbs amputated. 22 of them were children. The United Nations Commission also found that Israeli snipers deliberately shot at journalists, health workers, children, and persons with disabilities, knowing they were clearly recognizable as such. In one instance, an article in Haaretz features an interview with an Israeli sniper who boasts about having shot 42 knees in a single day. By contrast, 4 Israelis were injured during this entire period. Another important area of concern for the ICC is the building of illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. UN resolutions 446, 447 specifically call out Israel's illegal settlements in these areas and says that they are null and void, that they are illegal under international law. Israel has been ethnically cleansing Palestine for decades. Millions of Palestinians have been expelled in a diaspora, while millions of others are still living in Palestine as refugees, generation after generation, stateless on their own land. Israel's widespread practice of bulldozing people's homes in broad daylight has been ignored by the international community. Destroying people's homes, whether with bombs or bulldozers, and forcing them to flee so that you can bring in your own people is called ethnic cleansing. This is a brazen violation of international law. It is illegal under the Geneva Convention, and it is considered a crime against humanity. Not even a year ago, Netanyahu was still trying to push his annexation plan to seize the Jordan Valley and up to another 30% of the West Bank. After the ICC published its decision on February 5th, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu went on a tirade in which he expressed outrage and called the court's decision, quote, pure anti-Semitism. He said Israel would do everything it can to fight the ruling.
When the ICC investigates Israel for fake war crimes, this is pure anti-Semitism. The court established to prevent atrocities like the Nazi Holocaust against the Jewish people is now targeting the one state of the Jewish people.
Of course, what Netanyahu is saying here is absurd. The ICC does not prosecute entire countries. The ICC prosecutes individuals, whether they're government officials, military leaders, and so on, no matter what religion, ethnicity, or nationality they are, as it has done so in the past. Netanyahu also conveniently doesn't mention to you that the ICC's decision applies to everyone in Palestine. This means that the ICC can also investigate Hamas and the Palestinian Authority if it chooses to do so. Reacting to this announcement, Germany and Hungary's foreign ministers also came out against the decision. The German foreign minister tweeted that the court has no jurisdiction because of the absence of the element of Palestinian statehood required by international law. This is extremely hypocritical because the entire international community, they say Palestine is not a state, they prevent Palestine from becoming a state, and then when Palestinians try to obtain justice, they give them no other avenue. This doesn't change the fact that Palestine has already acceded to the Rome Statute in 2015. The United States, which subsidizes the Israeli occupation to the tune of $3.8 billion a year in military aid, so that it can shoot unarmed Palestinians in the knees and murder them in aerial bombardments, also condemned this announcement by the ICC. Remember, Israel is the largest recipient of aid from the United States since World War II. Even as recently as December 2020, in the middle of a pandemic and economic crisis, with millions of Americans jobless and without health care, the United States still gave Israel $500 million. Now, on the flip side, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority actually welcomed the decision by the ICC, despite the fact that they could also face prosecution themselves. Many NGOs and human rights groups also welcomed this ruling by the ICC, Amnesty International in particular said that an ICC investigation marks a long overdue step towards justice for victims and is a chance to end the cycle of impunity that is at the heart of the human rights crisis in the occupied Palestinian territories. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Reacting to the news that the International Criminal Court at The Hague would be expanding its jurisdiction to include the Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel since 1967 is Michael Link. He is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in Ontario and also the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He said that, quote, the leading political organs of the United Nations have repeatedly failed to enforce their own significant body of resolutions on the Israeli occupation. This ruling opens the door for credible allegations of Rome Statute crimes to be finally investigated and potentially reach the trial stage at the ICC. He joins me now. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. It's good to have you on.
My pleasure to be here, Richard.
So, Professor, this decision by the ICC surrounding its jurisdiction in Palestine, it's received a lot of pushback from not just Israel, but Germany, Hungary, the United States. We've seen the Israeli embassies, they've been dispatching their ambassadors to put a lot of pressure on other countries to tell the ICC not to go ahead with this. Netanyahu was saying that the ICC is anti-Semitic. Danny Dunnan, their permanent representative to the UN, was saying that Fatou Bensouda, the ICC chief prosecutor, should be indicted herself. So, I mean, what's your reaction to all this pushback from Israel and their allies?
Sure. It's, you know, the fundamental principle that every first-year law student learns in any law school around the world is the independence of the judiciary, that courts, once created and judges appointed, are to be independent of political influences and are to be able to make their decisions in full confidence that that their independence is going to be respected. That's the only way in which we build public trust in the operation of the courts and the rule of law. So ever since the ICC announced, or the prosecutor announced, that she was going to initiate investigations into the complaints coming to her office with respect to alleged war crimes, not only by Israel, but also by Palestinian armed groups as well, in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there has been a concerted pressure on the court. This reached its apex last year when the United States said it was going to ban the travel to the United States of any International Criminal Court officials. It's astounding to me in this modern day and age that the prosecutor and judges and staff of an independent international court would be under threat of arrest by a leading Western democracy, and the attention is not on the country or the groups who are alleged to have committed war crimes. This seems to have turned international criminal justice upside down.
And could you maybe tell us what are some of the consequences that Israeli officials or Palestinian officials could face if they're maybe charged or convicted? Because travel is obviously one of them. You know, they're afraid to travel to countries that are a party to the Rome Statute. What are some of the other obstacles or consequences they could face as a result of this?
Sure. One big one, obviously, is the fear of arrest. The practice of the court in other proceedings has to been to create, if you like, hidden indictments, which are then sent to all members of the state members of the International Criminal Court, and those indictments are sitting there waiting for a potential war criminal to come to their jurisdiction, by which they'd be arrested and then turned over to the ICC in The Hague. So that would be the concern of anybody who might be might have participated, either in a military sense or in a political sense, with respect to the commission of alleged war crimes. Either so the big impact will be on travel. Other impacts would be being arrested and then spending a long period of time as the guest of the ICC, either awaiting trial or, if convicted, then serving time in I believe Dutch jails.
The scope of the ICC's ruling includes Operation Protective Edge in 2014, the right to return protests or marches in 2018, and the illegal settlements that Israel has been building. Do you feel that's an adequate purview, or do you feel that there were some other things that could have been included in there?
I don't think the file is closed as to what the prosecutor might look at, assuming everything begins going forward with respect to investigation. You've mentioned the three principal areas involving Israel, but I could imagine that there might be future complaints which may turn into allegations of a war crime with respect to apartheid, with respect to wars of aggression, with respect to crimes against humanity. So all those are part and parcel of what could happen, depending on where the prosecutor goes and what facts are revealed to him or to her.
Isn't there a glaring double standard going on here? Because, you know, the Israelis are arguing that Palestine can't be considered under ICC jurisdiction because it doesn't possess key elements of effective territorial control. What they're saying essentially is that it's not a real state and that therefore the ICC can't say it has jurisdiction there. Yet just a few weeks ago, we were hearing from the Israelis in terms of the COVID vaccine. They said, oh, well, the Palestinians are on their own. They can stand on their own 2 feet. They're in charge of their own health affairs. Isn't that a striking double standard there and hypocrisy?
There is a two-sided argument there where it has to do with obligations of the occupier toward the protected population under occupation. Everything is then shifted over to the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority. And where it has to do with other issues, there is a denial that there's exists a Palestinian state. Remember this, you know, the ruling issued on Friday was a relatively narrow ruling. It didn't say that Palestine constitutes a state with respect to all aspects of international law. It said that it constitutes a state and therefore has the legal personality to sign the Rome Treaty and be bound by it within the definition of a state party for the purposes of the Rome Statute. So it's a narrower definition than what some people have attributed to it. It's a technical definition saying that the PA has enough attributes of legal personality to be able to sign the Rome Statute, and so the cries with respect to some Western countries that Palestine is not a state, that's a separate issue that will come down the road for other issues. I think they're overblowing it, and I when I hear that argument raised, including by my own government, it tells me that they can't be serious with respect to want to see, you know, justice applied impartially throughout the world, wherever the Rome Statute would wind up applying.
So, I mean, if we're potentially going to see some charges brought, how long do you think that process would take? Are we talking about a few years here, a few decades? What is typically the case?
We're on a bit of unknown ground, but keep this in mind. The Palestinian Authority has signed the Rome Statute, I believe, in January 2015, 6 years ago, and issued its initial complaints very shortly after that. So this has been before the court now for over 6 years, and we're only satisfying the end of the first of what are three stages: the preliminary investigation, the formal investigation, and then if it passes that hurdle, then the trial. So there might be complications with respect to gathering evidence. Israel will not allow investigators to come to either Israel or the West Bank or East Jerusalem. So all that can be done, they could go through Egypt into Gaza to be able to gather some evidence. But that, I think we would all acknowledge, it's going to be complicated and time-consuming, and the prosecutor is going to have to be satisfied that the evidence that he or she has gathered is going to be able to stand up in court. You want your evidence to be as solid as possible. On the other hand, the allegation with respect to the settlements, my sense is that's coming close to being an open and closed legal question. The settlements have been illegal under international humanitarian law since the Fourth Geneva Convention was adopted over 70 years ago. That was strengthened by the 1977 Additional Protocol, and that was a centerpiece of the war crimes listed in the 1998 Rome Statute. Yes, there will have to be issues addressed as to if the settlements are a violation of the Rome Statute, which it'd be difficult for me to see why they wouldn't be found to be. Then who do you wind up identifying as the individuals to whom Rome Statute charges would be laid against? Because as we know, the Rome Statute identifies individuals, not states, as those who would be in the docket and those who would wind up being indicted. So there would be some effort to have to identify the leading military or civilian or political leaders who played a significant part in the shaping of the settlements. And of course, the last issue would be the identification of leading political or military figures with respect to Palestinian armed groups to whom an indictment may be flowing towards as well.
Again, the ICC is saying it's ready to investigate both sides, not just Israel. You know, it hasn't even charged anyone with a crime yet. So it's quite astonishing to see so much pushback from this, to be frank.
To go to your point, I mean, this is one of the very few forms of modern, meaningful accountability that has arisen with respect to the 53-year-old unaccountable Israeli occupation. All of the hundreds of resolutions that have been adopted by the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, the UN Human Rights Council, among other leading UN bodies, there's been no steps taken with respect to any form of meaningful accountability with respect to Israel and its conduct of the occupation. Now, when Israel finally faces the prospect, still in the future, with respect to appearing in a docket to answer charges related to the Rome Statute, of course there is some worry, and I think that's justifiable worry. If the world had taken the issue of accountability seriously 40 years ago, 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been a need for an ICC process, because Israel would have been compelled by international pressure and international law to vacate its occupation and to allow full Palestinian self-determination on the Palestinian territory.
Thanks for your time, Professor. Again, great speaking with you.
My pleasure, Richard. Good luck with this.
The double standard displayed here by the Israelis is incredible, but not surprising, frankly. Once again, Israel claims that Palestine is not a real state and that therefore it cannot be placed under ICC jurisdiction. However, just a few weeks ago, when it came to Palestinians not having any sufficient doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, back then, Israel claimed that Palestine was responsible for its own jurisdiction. So once again, we see here the glaring hypocrisy of the Zionist regime. When it suits them, they're a democracy. They're the only democracy in the Middle East. But when it comes to actually holding military personnel and politicians accountable for possible war crimes, suddenly they're not interested in the pursuit of justice and accountability and checks and balances. And when it comes to the Palestinians being undervaccinated, not having access to the same public health facilities and infrastructure because their land is under occupation and they're constantly bombarded and murdered, Israel claims they're not standing in the way and Palestinians have self-determination. But when it comes to Palestinians actually seeking justice for the atrocities that they were submitted to, now Israel says they can't and speaks for them. This kind of impunity and how the Zionist occupation is able to get away with all these crimes is frankly astonishing. It's truly staggering. I mean, the statement by the ICC is not even a judgment or a ruling. It doesn't even charge anyone with a crime, let alone convict them. And even then, Israeli politicians, foreign leaders are up in arms as if it were the biggest affront on their person. The very prospect or notion that Israeli politicians and military leaders could face justice for carrying out war crimes and the most inhumane of acts is an insult to them. It's inconceivable in their view. This speaks to the derangement and the arrogance and the disconnect at play here. You can see how Israel is so used to oppressing the Palestinian people with impunity and getting away with it that this very idea that Palestinians could attain some sort of justice, some semblance of accountability, no matter how small, is perceived as an attack. But hopefully, hopefully, we do see some justice, we do see some accountability, and that this changes. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on yet another episode of The Lantern. In life, we will always be faced with situations that demand a great measure of assessment and evaluation from us. There are numerous narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, which advise us with great emphasis to think whatever we want to do through and not just jump into a situation blindly. This does not necessarily mean that we have to become cowardly in life and timid and overcautious and not be able to take chances and risks. But a person who tries throughout their life to develop a sense of awareness regarding themselves, first and foremost, and the situation and conditions around them, and constantly strives to prioritize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His satisfaction in everything they do, like we've mentioned in so many episodes before, will develop a furqan within themselves. Furqan is the ability to discern between bad and good, even during situations where the two are not discernible. They are ambiguous and vague. It's either a state of sedition or, you know, we don't have all the facts. It could be regarding any matter as big as election or buying a television. So a person who's constantly in a state of awareness and is careful of the choices they make in life because they know that the greatest loss is to lose an opportunity that will help them build a better afterlife. The greatest loss is to lose that favorable position they have in the eyes of Allah. The greatest loss is to lose a chance to satisfy God, please Him, to serve His servants, and to become better people. A person who lives in that state of awareness constantly will always be careful not to make stupid mistakes. But then again, we're human, and things happen in life that we wish they hadn't. I forgot to listen to a short story. I forgot for us to listen to a short story. Let's do that, and we'll be right back.
The whistle is the title of today's story on Lantern. 200 years ago, there lived in Boston a little boy whose name was Benjamin Franklin. On the day that he was 7 years old, his mother gave him a few pennies. It was the first money that he had ever had. "You may buy something if you wish," said his mother. "You must be careful not to spend these foolishly." The little fellow ran into the street. As Benjamin ran down the street, he wondered what he should buy. But there were 14 boys and girls older than he and two little sisters who were younger. What a big family he was, and the father was a poor man. No wonder the lad had never owned a toy. He had not gone far when he met a larger boy who was blowing a whistle. "I wish I had that whistle," he said. The big boy looked at him and blew it again. "Oh, what a pretty sound it made." "I have some pennies," said Benjamin. "You may have them if you will give me the whistle, all of them." "Yes, all of them." "Well, it's a bargain," said the boy, and he gave the whistle to Benjamin and took the pennies. Little Benjamin Franklin was very happy, for he was only 7 years old. He ran home as fast as he could. "See, Mother," he said, "I have bought a whistle." "How much did you pay for it?" "All the pennies you gave me." "Oh, Benjamin," one of his brothers asked to see the whistle. "Well, well," he said, "you've paid a dear price for this thing. It's only a penny whistle, and a poor one at that." The little boy saw what a mistake he had made. "Never mind, my child," said his mother very kindly. "The lesson you have learned today is never to pay too dear for a whistle." Benjamin Franklin lived to be a very old man, but he never forgot that lesson.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam says, "Time is the most valuable thing. Health is the most valuable thing. Your youth is the most valuable thing. Family is the most valuable thing." It is because these things, these factors, can act as mediums to help me obtain a prosperous afterlife. They're like provisions that I can send forth to build castles and palaces, in fact, for myself, that would last me forever. I could spend my money. Wealth could be valuable. I could spend it building mansions for myself here, buying expensive cars, hoarding antiques and furniture and jewelry. That would end as soon as my life ends, a life which there's no telling when it would come to an end. Or I could spend that wealth helping other people, building orphanages, making other people's lives better, investing in the new generation, underprivileged people, for them to have better education, access to clean water, a better, more sustainable support for them to have better lives. Now, by doing so, I could turn the very wealth that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about in the Quran and says that for a person who's dying and who's gasping their final breath, that wealth that they cultivated all their lives is worthless and useless. I could turn that very wealth into something that could be baqiyat al-salihat for me. It could be an investment that would last all eternity. Another and almost final point on the value of things is the value of our life. A beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the value of your life, yourself, your nafs, your soul, is paradise. Don't settle for anything less. The only thing I should be willing to trade my time and life for is Jannah, is eternal felicity, is endless prosperity, is an afterlife which is guaranteed to make me happy. That's the only thing I should trade my life and time for. Nothing else. Investing in nothing else would make sense if I look at the world that way. And as the verse in the Holy Quran says, "Inna Allah ishtara min al-mu'minin anfusahum wa amwalahum bi anna lahumul jannah." Verily, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala buys from the believers their lives and their wealth, because for them is the paradise. That's the only thing I should invest in, and that's the only thing that I should spend all my pennies and dimes and all the whistles in the world and my life for. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. We want to talk about Iran's developments since 1979 in different fields and different aspects. Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So, since the occurrence of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979, about 42 years have passed, and in these, we can say 42 years, different achievements and developments were made by the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's right. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the developments which took place after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Islamic Republic of Iran, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, is famous for establishing justice, and also we talked about it, also the scientific developments, we also talked about it. But one of the mottos of the Islamic Republic of Iran at the very beginning was establish spirituality among the people and boosting this kind of Muslim and Islamic spirit among the people. First of all, talk a little bit about this. Did really Islamic Revolution of Iran and the establishment of Islamic Republic of Iran had a role in changing the we can say beliefs of the people in terms of being a Muslim? I mean, Islam has existed 1,400 years before that too, but can we say that Islamic Revolution of Iran had a role in changing your life as a Muslim and being like a Muslim?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, for sure. The answer is yes. Why? Because being someone who is from outside the Islamic Republic of Iran, I feel honorable to being a Muslim. I got honor to be the Shia. Now I know what is the power of Islam. Mm-hmm. After this revolution, what is the power of being a Shia? All these things are because of the Islamic Revolution. Why? Because before, obviously, we were Muslims, but we were always told by the scholars, or, you know, the big people of the big scholars, maybe they are the, whether they were the Islamic scholars or non-Islamic, they used to say, like, Muslims are backward and it is West who is basically growing.
Okay.
And they're having growth. They were seeing growth in the technology only. They were seeing the growth in having money, in having more infrastructure.
That's right.
And that is not all. Because we can see some people who do not have anything, but still, they have peace. They have inner peace. They sleep in the night peacefully without any stress or anything. And that goes back to the spirituality. That goes back to your spirit. That goes back to your inner peace that you have. The Islamic Revolution, after the revolution where it has gained all those, we can say, like, successes that it has in the field of, for example, armed forces or the technology and all those. On top of that, being a Muslim, obviously, this Islamic Revolution has showed us how to be a good Muslim, how to raise your voice against the oppression. Like, if you are a Muslim and if you're living in a Muslim territory, how you need to respect others. This has been shown in this country, in this country, when I visited here. And obviously, if you go to Dubai, Emirates, you see a Muslim country, but you don't see that much Islam. Mm. Except if it is Adhan, you have to go and pray.
You see big towers.
Yes, you see big towers.
Yeah.
You can celebrate New Year the way you celebrate in the West.
Yeah.
Everything is allowed. It is so-called Muslim country.
Yeah.
If you go to Saudi Arabia, yes, people, they go for the prayers. They leave their shops open. Mm. But the rest, you cannot see that spirituality within the people.
Mm, yes.
Whereas you can see this in this country, mm-hmm. when you visit this country.
That's right.
There's
okay.
a big difference. You know, when That's we right. visit from outside, especially when the Western people from America or Europe or Australia, when we have these Muslim, our brothers, when they visit Iran, they totally are changed. And obviously, you know that the media propagate different things.
Yes.
And they see the vice versa over here.
Yes.
And then the spirituality that they gain from here, yeah. obviously, that is much boosting.
Especially the rituals in Iran, yes. in the Shia terms of the world, is very famous. And Brother Ali Alavian, Islamic Revolution of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, is famous to revive these rituals. And I think these rituals, I mean, dua sessions, supplications, commemoration ceremonies for the Ahlul Bayt and Prophet Muhammad, and the other rituals and the ceremonies had really role in boosting the people, spiritually speaking, isn't it?
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Yeah, this spiritual thinking actually took place at a time when man, disillusioned from the schools of West and East, was looking for an opening to find the light of truth. And based on what the leader of the Islamic Ayatollah Khamenei once said, and actually he explained this great change in the Islamic revolution in these words. I just want to refer to his words as I have actually have it with me.
That's right.
The leader says that, in fact, our great Imam, Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi, with his divine revolution, made the abandoned Quran famous. Quran was abandoned. I'll bring my evidences on what the leader says here. And the hidden tradition, the famous tradition. So he changed the hidden tradition to a famous one. And the abandoned religion to the religion which is not more abandoned. So look, brother, there are some factors that and indicators that we can reach to approve whatever the leader said here. The promotion of culture of Quran, the culture of Salat, praying, and also the culture of martyrdom and Shahada. These are the three indicators that I want to talk about, that they are the outcome and fruits of this revolution.
Okay.
Look, Quran in the before the revolution was not the Quran that we today know and actually see. The Quran was something which was used only for the programs like, for example, demise of a person, or it was somewhere in the houses for personal usage. But have you ever witnessed any, for example, Quranic gathering or majalis or gatherings of memorization
especially
of the Quran recitation?
Month of Ramadan, that's right.
So we have seen this progress in the last 40 years, four decades of revolution, brother. So no one can deny how drastically the role of Quran actually changed. And it comes, and it came to the lives of the people now. Thinking on Quran, different institutions who are working on the interpretation and also pondering on the verses of the Holy Quran, and they have some programs for our youth, and they work with them. We have more than 20,000 memorizers of the whole Quran now. I mean, these statistics I think are for 34 years ago. Definitely they have increased by now. So this is what the kind of attention that has been given only to Quran. If I ask you that, have you ever noticed how greatly the role of this revolution in promoting the place of the value of Salat in our society? One might say, okay, even in the time of Shah, people were more religious and they actually did their prayers in time and they had no problem. And we at least did not change a lot in this regard. And we did not promote in this, did not develop and progress in this regard. I want to say, no, it was not like that.
What was the Azan sound heard in the neighborhoods before the revolution too or not?
Yeah, it was.
The masajid, it was?
Yeah, it was, okay. Yeah.
But the number of masajid were not...
Number of masajid, brother. Number of congregation, jama'ah, salats, number of jum'ah gatherings for salat al-jum'ah. Look, they are the number... If we want to be a bit meticulous in the increase and progress of the number of those who were saying prayer at that time and today, it is not comparable. You can ask your fathers or your grandfathers to see the number of people who were actually taking part in congregation prayers at that time and today. Mm-hmm. And look, very simply, how many Imam of Jum'ah did we have at the time of Shah, and how many do we have today? Mm-hmm. So this is a good comparison to check and see how this progress is drastic. The next, which I want to talk about, the prayer majalis, prayers and dua majalis and supplication gatherings, like that of, for example, Dua Kumail and others that we see today. And also the i'tikaf, which is, I think, to my own understanding, i'tikaf is something exceptional. Look, at the time of Shah, based on the statement that was said by the leader himself, he said, at the time of Shah, we were only 50 and just talibas who did i'tikaf in the masjid of Imam Hassan al-Askari in Qom. But now we have more than 1 million, 1.5 million youth and youngsters going to i'tikaf, and this is also...
Sorry, Brother Ali, the question is this, and do you believe that all these statistics show a kind of a spiritual development among the people? These are numbers.
Look, brother, if we want to make something more tangible and bring it to a good indicator to judge about it, we need to focus on some numbers. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes it is required to make it a statistical. Look, when I'm talking about this, at least if we want to say, comparing to the population of that time, 50 at the year 1979, 50 people. Now, what could be the ordinary number for today? It could be, for example, 1,000, no, 5,000, 10,000 people. But when we see more than 1.5 million of our youth going and doing i'tikaf and actually staying in one place for 3 consecutive days, it means that there was a change in this regard.
That's right.
So the kind of look which can be given to this is, I think it is worth interpretation. That's it, right. Is worth interpreting. The next indicator that I want to mention is progress in the culture of martyrdom and shahada.
Mm-hmm. The culture of shahada, okay.
Yeah. Look, people from revolution and some years before and specifically after revolution actually found the role models that they have been talking about for more than 14 centuries, from the dawn of Islam and the movement of Imam Hussein Ali Salam, actually they realized it. They materialized it, and they actually it started from 8-year war, and even it becomes a part of our culture. And our young youth are willing to go to sacrifice themselves for the sake of religion, for the sake of their country, for the sake of defending the Islamic territory, not Iranian territory, Islamic territory. When you actually show your readiness to go to defend, for example, Syrian Muslims or Yemenis or, for example, Iraqis, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. So you are sacrificing the most valuable property that a person has in his life. And based on Imam Ali alayhi salam's quote that he says, the most precious wealth of a person is his life.
That's right.
And you are ready to sacrifice it for the sake of your religion.
Okay.
So it means that it becomes a part of the culture. And what is the root of it? The root of it is in Imam Hussein's movement.
That's right, and spirituality.
They understood that this role model was not only for that piece of history. It needs to be repeated here today again. So the role models are slowly and gradually finding their place in this society.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian and Said Mohsen Naghvi, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, which was regarding the spiritual developments made after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And dear listeners, visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت برايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسودا هلف بالخمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's Center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders. But not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink. Who's going to answer those questions? It's pretty important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.